You're always a requested guest. Even though you have your own podcast, people are like, oh, we want to hear Brian Barney. We want to hear.
Well, they want to hear a conversation between us guys, yeah, you know, I think is the deal. So, no, it's awesome. Yeah, thanks for the invite. I really appreciate it.
So we got Brian Barney and we got Scott Reekers.
Got it right.
Oh, man, I nailed it.
First try.
I couldn't get it right twice. So we'll say one and done, right? You guys got a booth over here?
We do. 7218.
Work in the Eastman's booth?
Yep.
Okay.
We did a little shift this year. We said, you know what? We record so many podcasts and we were trying to do a bunch of different stuff. We're like, we're going to do all podcasts this year. It's like, so we record like 20 something each time. So
you're here?
Yeah.
Don't say that out loud.
Yeah. We don't know that we should do that.
Between four or five podcasts. It isn't all for one, but
we shoot for five. Yeah. Five or six. Like two a day, I'm wore out.
Okay. So we get five or six per title.
Better? Okay. Yeah, much better.
Quality over quantity. I think the first one we tried to get like a dozen or 14, and I forgot how to talk by the end.
I was just worn out. Yeah. Like, you have to think constantly throughout the day. Then you try to go to the show and walk around, and then you get more drained. And
So we set this goal where we were going to have a podcast the first time every hour and a half that we did it, because we came the first time and they said, just record some.
Every hour.
Yeah. Yeah. So back then we were in, it was a retailer's booth and they just gave us some space. So next year, Brian and I are like, dude, we're going to be so ambitious. We're going to fill out like half the year. So we don't have to plan anything for hunting season, because Brian and I've worked on how long? Well, we're just talking about 10 years now.
Yeah. In the 10th year of the podcast.
Gotcha. Yeah. Has it been that long?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wow. Dang. Time flies.
Yeah, he just told me that this morning and then I realized he's right and I feel old. So
we're all getting old.
Yeah.
Man, 10 years. That's wild. Give us a quick rundown. What do you guys do at Eastman's?
Yeah, so been partnered with Eastman's for years. So started off by writing in the magazines, and eventually they gave me a chance to write some staff articles in there. And so they asked me for a couple ideas for staff articles, and I think I sent them 30 the next day. And so I've been writing ever since for them. I've been writing for those guys, and then we started the podcast 10 years ago, Eastman's Elevated. So I've been running that. We have another podcast, Eastman's Bow Hunting Journal. I do with Dan Bacar, bow hunting specific. So that one's been a fun one. We're in our second year of that. And they've given me some opportunity to do some film work. So we put some films together, and I always thought I'd make the coolest films with the big adventures I go on. And then they turn on the camera and I forget how to talk, you got to actually tell a story, that's condensed down. And so it's taken a while, but I'm really proud of some of the products we're putting out, some of the films we're putting out now, but it takes a while to get comfortable with the camera and things. So that's kind of what I do is produce content for Eastman's.
And then he's being way too modest. Okay. So here's the other side of the story. I wasn't there when this happened, but there's a different editor, but Brandon Mason, who's been on our team for years, they were both standing in front of this. We used to have this board where we put the magazine up. So this is a long time ago. And as they worked on it, you put it out and plan. And Brandon's like, wasn't he in the last magazine with a feature story?
Picked it out.
And
did you pick out the individual or the animal?
It was the individual, because we kept noticing this dude named Brian Barney is constantly sending us stories. Gotcha. And so that's how it turned into, that's why they requested, was because I think he was up to like 10 feature stories of trophy animals. So Brian's being modest, but it was his submissions and being this consistent killer over time. That's why they requested, hey, we really want you to write some staff articles.
And
then it turns into history you just told. So pat you on the back a little bit.
Yeah, thanks. I need that every once in a while.
What do you do full time?
I'm our podcast lead in business development, help with a lot of our research side. So that's been what I've done the last 10 years. I'll help with some of the sales, kind of depending on situation. Mm-hmm. But podcasts eat up a lot of my time, as well as business development. It means I take new ideas and turn them into the things that we're doing. So if we've got something new at Eastman's, chances are my fingerprints were on it in the early phases to get it started and hand it off to somebody.
And you live in Pal?
Yep, I do.
How do you feel about the like new preference point or application fees? Is the non-resident stings pretty good?
There are a few things I hate for non-residents. Number one, our price structure for antelope is terrible.
Yeah, it's like, rough.
It's rough for non-residents. I talk to a lot of non-residents. And for guys that have been, if you're 10, 15 points deep in like for antelope, and you're going to end up like in $2,000 just for the tag, plus all the points, and now they're slapping on an application fee, man,
I'm in that boat right now.
Yeah.
It's like trying to add that up. I'm like, oh, wow, that was an expensive tag after all that.
I tease that Wyoming hates bow hunters and hates non-residents. No,
we talk about it constantly. Yeah. At least once a podcast, I'm like, man, I love Wyoming, but they hate non-residents.
And you want these states to take care of their residents, and have those opportunities. So I understand. So I half jokingly say it, but every year those words do come out of my mouth.
And it's a frustrating deal because, you know, like doing what we do, we talk to a lot of people that call in and they, you know, a lot of times people just want their idea affirmed that, hey, this is a good tag that I'm applying for. Mm-hmm. So sometimes you're just coaching them. You're making the right decision. They're looking at the exact same data. We are walking them through it. Mm-hmm. And so they want that. But then when they go to apply, especially, you know, the special is the one that's really expensive.
Yeah.
But on the same end, I was talking to a couple of our outfitter partners and, you know, looking at the data, the sheer number of people that dropped out of the special, mm-hmm. that was the reason for it.
Sure.
It was an intent to get a bunch of the people at the top end out of the point pool. So I understand the logic, but do I like the bank account statement afterwards? Yeah. No, not a bit.
We added up last night. We had dinner, and I was talking to Omar about it. We added up, so like if you pay an application fee, a point fee, the 2.5% fee on mm-hmm. top of what you pay for processing, I think you're going to be into it, like $330, $340 for three species, elk, deer, antelope, if you apply to MBOT points, which is a real stinger.
Things are really changing. Like, we have to continue to adapt and evolve with them. But I remember the early 2000s and 2010s, like all the cool places I got to hunt for low points. Yeah. So point creep is getting me in a lot of these states. But, you know, I just find different states. I find different units, different places to go. And then I run a rotation of units and states. So I've always got hunts coming up every single year. And deer and elk are really what I focus on. So I want to make sure that I've got those hunts every year. And for deer with a bow, I always want an early season and always want a late season. And I'm still able to do that, but it does hurt my feelings a bit. Like, some of these great places I've been able to hunt that I could get in for two points that now I'll never be able to hunt again. And they have like a special place in my heart, but we just have to continue to adapt. And, you know, I can't go back to the 70s, to the good old days of mule deer. So this is the good old days for me. And I just continue to work hard at it in the research and developing these units and these spots. And then, you know, able to find some pretty gosh dang good hunting.
My freshman year of college, I went to school in St. George, which is right on the border, Arizona border. As a freshman, I could have bought over-the-counter archery tags for the strip. Trail. I never did. No, I went to school there for 2 years and never bought an over-the-counter archery tag for the strip.
Did you know about the strip then?
I knew about it. Just the weight of what that opportunity was. It only, you know, hindsight's 2020, right? You look back on that and you're like, oh man, what did I do?
Yeah.
But yeah. Yep. You have a full-time job, right?
Mm-hmm. I've been continuing to work in the outdoor industry, and now that takes up a bunch of my time, which is good in the way I want it. But I do have a small construction company that I've ran for 20 years. Mm-hmm. We keep it small now. We're not doing quite as many houses per year, but we'll do a house and finish it off. We've got a good name and a good reputation, and really it's afforded me to go to a lot of these places. It's kind of been my number one sponsor throughout the years as my full-time job. So it's been good.
Construction.
Yeah.
The reason I asked that, I wanted to ask you, and I bet you get to ask this question, I bet you do as well. So you have people that want to get into hunting, they want to get into the industry, and they're like, should I get into the industry? Should I try to make a play to like get a job, you know, whether it's, you know, Go Hunt or Eastman's or some other company, or should I try to find some means of providing a living for myself, financial freedom to go on some hunts and some free time? So like what advice do you give people in that regard?
Yeah.
For somebody that really loves to hunt.
Yeah. I think, for somebody that really loves to hunt, there's more money to be made in different fields that can help sponsor these hunts and free up, different time to go on them. You know, if it's your true passion and you work hard at it, like there's a will, there's a way. I mean, we have Omar sitting here who's worked his way into the industry just for the sheer love of it, you know, and all of us guys. Mm-hmm. And so you can definitely make it, but it's not going to be an easy road. But if you're passionate about it and you get a job in that field and you really enjoy what you do, I think you could really go either direction. But the trades is a great way to go. You work hard, you make money. money. You're able to go on hunts, have time away to go on these things. And so it's worked really well for me. And then, yeah, just fortunate to be able to work my way, you know, into the outdoor industry and be able to support myself and my family now from it, and still have my hands kind of in the construction company. And so it's just worked well for me to have my hands in a couple different baskets, you know?
Yeah. You mentioned earlier, like, got started, like, you know, pitching stories to Eastman's and writing a bunch. Like, what it is about writing and, like, helping people that you enjoy, that you keep doing it, and now obviously doing podcasts for 10 years. Like, what is that enjoyment?
Yeah, what is the motivation?
Yeah, so I think I really like solving the puzzle of, like, public land do-it-yourself hunting. And I kind of I overthink everything about it. And so I'm just taking my experience and sharing it with other guys. But I love going to all these different places, having these wild adventures. I love chasing these critters. And so for me, it was like sharing this information. Like, I have all this information in my head that I've learned throughout the years, and kind of sharing that with other guys and helping them with their journey. And so I think the fun is really in doing it and just being able to share that with guys throughout the years. I love the written word, the writing, where I can really think of my word choice and I can really think of how I want to phrase these articles or how I want it to read, and then I can read back through it and make sure that information comes through. And the whole time, you know, I'm building my competition as well, as I'm sharing all these secrets or all this information I've gained throughout the years, but I'm also evolving and learning and continuing to up my game, you know? And so I kind of feel like I can share this information and it doesn't affect my hunting. And that, even though I know it kind of does, I'm building my competition and, you know, teaching these guys. But I do like sharing the information. I like seeing guys be successful. And I think there's still great opportunity out there. And so just trying to share that information I've learned.
Mm-hmm. Do you think, I feel the same. Do you, and I know you guys are in a very similar business to us. I mean, helping people try to draw tags, get permits, you know, tips, tricks, get into the field, be more successful. But then you look across harvest statistics across the West, and they generally don't fluctuate a ton.
It's really difficult, right? Yeah, it's so tough that you can put the information out there, and only the guys that take it, use it, put in the work are going to be successful.
I'll use this as a little fun fact. Have you guys looked at the Wyoming general tag sales?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. They're going down.
Sure.
For mule deer. Mm-hmm. I haven't deep dived on elk. I'm a mule deer guy, okay?
Good. Well, we're up on time.
Wrap it up.
It's been fun.
But I think we're seeing, 10 years we can have this conversation again to see if my hypothesis is right. Number one, we're watching a mass exodus at the top end of the baby boomers leaving hunting. So there's that, so there's that statistic. So I think that is there. They're not even casually buying tags just to be sitting and looking at some place that a deer might just come out. I don't think they're doing that. I also think that we've got, people are saying they're seeing more people in the field, but region G and H are at the lowest number of non-resident tags that they are at. I've talked to the biologist and I know the way they count. Like, I've got some questions. Okay. Mm-hmm. Like, I've got some questions on the way they count people. But what I do think is up is the number of days in the field.
Sure.
Because our equipment's just better. I mean, look at the stuff that we've got. So it's more comfortable to be there for longer. And then people are also willing to burn a lot more vacation time. Like, circling back to what you guys said, I grew up in Southwest Wyoming. There are coal miners. There are trona miners. They work 14 days a month. And so, and on top of that, they only have to burn about 40 hours of the PTO to get 3 weeks straight in the field during archery season. Right. I knew many that did that. So, like what you did, but they built it into a system where they had the consistent paycheck and they could get the overtime as well. So, you know, like back in the 90s, they're making $90,000 a year working at a mine, and, you know, and they're getting so they can, you know, but back then lots of people did not apply out of state. A lot of people had the dream of, I'll go apply and do it once. You know, now it's like, okay, how do I have a strategy to do multiple hunts a year? And so I think honestly, some of what we're seeing right now is a combination. There's a lot of guys trying to get out of the system. They're trying to burn their points. A lot of baby boomers in particular, they're 15, 20 points deep, whatever state. And they're like, this is my last chance. I want to get out. Maybe I'll go try a high opportunity state. But I think we're going to see it go down. And we're going to see some of the hunter numbers go down because baby boomers are a huge segment of our population. But the millennials and Z are large, and we're the ones entering our prime, and we can spend more time in the field.
Yeah.
So that correlates back to the success percentage. I don't think the success percentage is going to change.
Yeah.
So the conservation side becomes really important to make sure we have the same number of deer on the hill.
How much fluctuation do you think in Wyoming specifically was due to like the 2022-3 winter, especially in those two regions? Do you think that people didn't apply, dropped off, bought points because of the potential that doesn't exist maybe like it did 10 years ago?
I applied for, like, I grew up hunting Reed and G&H.
Sure.
I mean, it's just, so it's my, like, you can tell me a basin, I can tell you, yeah, I was there in such and such a year. And that's like, there's very few spots that I haven't at least touched somewhat just because 41 years old, spent a lot of time there.
Yep.
It is not what it once was. Mm-hmm. The only thing I can say is now, I feel like I'm getting old saying this. The only thing I can say is that I've now seen multiple cycles where they've come back, you know, so we, you know, Brian and I've had the benefit of being around the Eastmans, and they've got, from the 50s, we've got footage, you know, there's so much footage that is there, and you can see the cycles, you know, the winter of 82 was bad. That was when my dad moved to Wyoming. And then there was another year, one of my first years as a kid, when I was deer hunting, dad was from Iowa. He didn't know what he was doing. And resources like Eastman's were finally coming around, started in 87. And so, but that winter of 92, dad was like, I used to come up here and you could drive and there were deer around every third corner.
90s were rough.
They were bad.
I mean, Southern Utah, they were rough. I mean, the first buck I ever killed was a 2-point. It was the only buck I saw, you know?
Yep.
I mean, it was rough.
So it's cyclical.
Yeah.
Now, I took a lot of flack on this. I wrote an article that said why I'm not going to hunt G&H this year. And, I had a lot of people in the biology space call me, like, why are you saying this? I'm like, the director of Wyoming Game and Fish said it was an 80% die-off.
Yeah,
I can do
pretty
math.
Pretty alarming, yeah.
Yeah, I can do math. Maybe he wasn't supposed to say that publicly. Yeah. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But I can do math, and I mathed it backwards and said, that puts us somewhere in this range.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I kind of, you know, pat myself on the back a little bit because I got the math right because they came back with the aerial count, and it was right. But, you know, the cool part was they're already over 11,000. So go from 6,500 to 8,000 to a population by aerial count over 11,000. That's rapid.
Yeah.
I'm not going to go back until it's over 20,000.
Right.
I just don't feel right about doing it on a general tag.
Yeah. So I've talked to people that have said that they feel like the bucks that did make it are in really good condition. They were survivors. They made it through the winter and they're tough, and they're actually seeing some really good bucks because there's the potential there for space to be freed up, better feed. Mm-hmm. So like those bucks are getting ice cream plants more so than they would be if there was 20,000 or 30,000 deer on the landscape.
Well, and two, do you want to wait till somebody tells you it's good? Sure. Or do you want to be the first part, person right? in there to find out it's good? Exactly. And the deer that die off are the youngest ones and the oldest ones, which means the 2 to 4 year old deer or bucks survive. Well, now those bucks are 4 to 6, they're prime age to take.
Prime age
and they've had good feed the last couple of years and mild winters. So it's, you know, these places, do you want to wait till everybody tells you it's good and then it's 15 points? Or do you want to be the one that takes a chance and goes in there?
Risk.
So, I'm a lot of my areas that I hunt in Wyoming, I'm going to scout this year. I'm not going to apply for a tag, but I'm just going to go look at a lot of my spots and just see how they're recovering, see how the bucks are looking. And then, I'll pull the trigger sooner rather than later. In there for sure.
Yeah.
Even that, what you just said right there, that's like a huge gold nugget. I don't think a lot of people do. If you live out west, it's a little bit easier to scout it before you try to apply for it. Like, if you're going to burn those points, and especially in those areas that take so much points for a non-resident to draw, it's really important you get it on the right year and go out and check it out.
Like, yep. And looking at winter ranges, you can see what type of bucks are around. They're going to put another year of growth. I've been looking at winter ranges. And so scouting isn't just summer either. You know, you can scout during all seasons. But the finding the trends in these units of when they're good. And then you can go to a unit that's been good to you before. And then you go there and maybe it's mismanaged. Maybe they had a drought. Maybe they had a bad winter. And all of a sudden, it's not nearly the unit it was the last time you hunted it. So you definitely have to keep up on trends of these units when you're going to go hunt them.
Yeah, we spent the whole last podcast that we just put out Thursday. We spent probably 45 minutes talking about drought and snowpack. I went back and listened to it, and I was like, man, this is probably so boring to some folks. But reality
is, I wanted to do the whole podcast about that. There's so much more I didn't get to talk about.
Reality is guys like us sit around and talk about that kind of stuff, and we look at it. It matters. Like, it has real implications on where we decide to apply and hunt.
Because this is almost one of the most exciting times of the year, like the research thing, like how excited we are just talking about random things about, like, okay, yeah, winter kill and population numbers. It's like, this is fun.
Yeah,
this is the fun time of year to geek out and look at stuff you hunted before or new things you want to check out.
I wanted to ask you, so you brought up, you know, there's more people, I don't know if there's more people, but it seems like more people are spending more time, right? More days, more hunter days in the field. You know, you do a lot of content. We do content. We talk about tips and tricks and how to apply and how to get tags, and we do all these things. But how do you continue to find success?
Yeah, I think for me, just continuing to adapt and evolve with it. I think as tags get tougher and tougher to come by, it's really spending the time in these units and in these tags to get the most out of them. And, you know, you learn so much by hunting a unit. Mm-hmm. And so if you can hunt these units year after year, every couple of years, you start to compound, you know, your knowledge about these places and where these animals hang out. Like, I hunt some real high pressure units, and I'm still finding tremendous bucks and tremendous bulls because I figure out where they refuge, where the pressure pushes them to, where the remote stretches of the unit are, places that are tough to get to. So, like, you know, hunting during the week, you know, there's like all these tricks to it, but you have to factor in the hunting pressure. But I'm still able to go in all these places and go find my own experience. I won't combat hunt, so I'm not going to battle with somebody else to get a stock on a buck. So if I go into a unit and there's a lot of guys in there, I'm going to go find a different unit or a different place in the unit. Even if the bucks are a touch smaller, I want that experience. And so that's what I look for. So I think I just continue to adapt and evolve. And the thing I really work at is my hunting skill set. Is I'm trying to be the best bow hunter I can be. So, you know, just like Brady's running, I'm running all winter long. I'm working on my fitness. I'm working on my knowledge. I'm working on my hunting instincts. So my stalking skills. I'm working, you know, on my shooting. I see you trail shooting indoor. I've been shooting indoor all winter long. 100 arrows a day.
I got 20,
building back
20
up
arcs.
My base. Yeah.
We're really going to go buy a target.
I'm headed to buy a target.
That's
just
it.
Just this afternoon because I needed a new one anyway.
So it's like really working on my craft of being the best bow hunter I can be and showing up to these trailheads and being undeniable. Like, I put in all the work, all the scouting, all the research. I know the unit. I know my skills are solid. And then I go in there and I go grind. And I'm dedicating more days to these hunts because my goals have got bigger throughout the years of what I'm shooting for, and tend to put in those days. And magic seems to find me, or success seems to find me. And so, yeah, I really hone in on working on my craft of bow hunting.
What do you think the biggest factor, like, if you could just give one nugget, like, what do you think, like, a person, what do you think that people aren't successful? To me, I always think that just people give up too quick. I just think they get uncomfortable and they're like, you know what, it's not, I don't know how many bow hunts I've been on where at some point during the bow hunt, and I've said this a lot, I've felt like this thing I'm trying to do is impossible. Like, I will not be able to do this. Like, this is not going to work, but I don't go home. I just keep trying. And then, like, when it does come together, I'm like, wow, I can't believe that worked. I can't believe it happened.
I think that's great insight, Trail.
How do you teach that, though?
That's mental fortitude, and I think you have to fail, and you have to push through tough times and continue to believe that you can be successful, put all the work in the in your preseason and in your preparation where you go in and you put too much into it to give up. So I think you're tapping into, like, the mental fortitude or the mental strength, the mental component. I think it all starts and ends with the mind. So I definitely think that's, like, a huge piece of the puzzle. You know, I I think that's a big piece. And I think those hunting instincts, like making the right moves, it's so tough with a bow and arrow, like being able to adapt. I get to a unit and, you know, my number one plan, I'm going to go into this place and I'm going to go find bucks. And I get in there and there's no bucks or there's people in there. So your ability to be able to adapt, or you find bucks in a south-facing feature and you look for that feature inside the unit, and just your ability to keep grinding and adapt and then get into the critters, create opportunities. And then, you know, I've been doing it long enough and I believe in my craft. And so, you know, eventually like my stalking and my shooting comes together where I get a chance or an opportunity and I make good on it. And so, you know, if there is one thing, I think it is working on your craft. I would agree with you that the mental fortitude is so important, but those hunting instincts, developing those through experience really dictates the decisions you make, dictates like being successful when you do get an opportunity. You find a big buck or a big bull, like, you know, I've got a bunch of animals under my belt. Like I know what works and what doesn't. So for me, I mean, it isn't quite black and white, but I know what a high percentage chance and a low percentage chance, when to go all in, when not to. And so, you know, once you start to build that confidence, I start to believe in my system and know kind of what's right and wrong for my style of bow hunting. Yeah.
Being adaptable is, I think, a great point.
Yeah.
I mean, I could think of one, and it's a buck that haunts me. Like a legit 200-inch typical. And saw him twice ever. And I would go to the same knolls and I would look for that buck day in, day out. I hunted him, I don't know how many, the whole bow hunt, and never put eyes on him. He was just low country, cedar sage, you know. Never put eyes on him. And one day I glassed all morning till like 11:30, pulled off the knob, hiked down, got to my truck, ran into two guys that had a broke down four wheeler. And I started talking to them and I said, oh, I could throw your four wheeler in my truck and give you a ride to the highway. And they were like, oh, what are you hunting? I said, I'm hunting deer. And they're like, oh man, we saw a giant this morning. And I was like, really? And he's like, yeah, we have some video. Pulls his video out. It's the buck I've been looking for. Like that, those guys were literally less than a half mile from me, just looking into a different drainage. And like, I got stuck in, this is where I've seen that buck. I'm going to find that buck. And I just wasn't adaptable. Like I just wasn't moving as much as I should be, trying different spots, looking to, you know, different knolls, different drainages. I knew he was in the general area, but I just got stuck on like, this is how this is going to play out. In my mind, I'd convince myself like, this is how this is going to work. And you know, if I just put in the time, he's going to be there. It's going to work out like I think. And you know, I don't know where that buck, I think that buck died of old age. Like nobody killed that buck. I'll show you a picture later. Just an absolute giant, but it still haunts me.
Well, everyone we kill, there's a handful that get away. Nope. You
do,
know?
Do you have a buck or a bull? Either of you?
Oh, I've got a, well, it's been on a film, so I can talk about him. I think he was a 210 non-typical.
Yeah.
I found him in the high country in the summer, and I went back Labor Day weekend, and I found him again. But he hadn't stripped yet, but he was, you can see antler, you know, the look where it's getting close. And so we went in and I never found him during rifle season. We spent a full week up there. And I wasn't going to have time to come back. So we ended up killing he's a big 3x3 that I'd seen that summer, and I killed him. And we, you know, it was one of the llama hunts that we did, but I never found that big non-typical again. I don't think he died that winter. But he definitely didn't come back. Drought really changed the habitat the next year. So it spread the deer out.
That's another great point. That people go back to the same spots year in, year out, and they don't really take into account like what the landscape is giving you. I think, you know, things change, drought, water years, snowpack.
So, but we found other big deer. I never found him again. So that's one. There's another one that I've got is he ended up being 191 and 6/8 once after he dried, but he's beautiful. Typical. He had one little extra point on him. But I didn't kill him. A guy that I ended up becoming friends with did kill him. I watched him all of August. I found him in September. He was not in a good spot to go in with my bow, so I just left him alone.
That's so hard.
It was. Well, it would have been forcing the issue. I would have had to come in right on top of him in cliff bands, and whereas I knew I could be set up above those cliff bands on opening morning of rifle and kill him. And we get in there, and he changed basins. Like, and so I hunted it hard, and we moved a lot. We were adaptable, but we just never, you know, never really exactly found him. Well, sure enough, 3 days into the hunt, this guy that we'd met that was on the hill, good dude, he went down to go get water. He had decided he was going to stay a couple more days, went down to go get water, just had a different angle, and found him. Like, he radioed us. He's like, well, guys, good news is I killed the buck. He's like, but I think it might be the one you were chasing.
Oh, no.
But he didn't owe me anything. I literally met him on the mountain. Sure. So it's one of those, I can't be mad at him, but it was. Yeah, it was 190 inch typical.
You ever miss a big buck or bull?
Oh, God. How many? Yeah, every way from Sunday. Yeah. Yeah, I've missed. I've messed up encounters and stalks. And they'll break your heart for sure. Mm-hmm. Even just last season, they'll break my heart. I ended up killing a couple nice bucks, a good early season, good late season buck that I'm really proud of. But yeah, that early season, I had another buck I was chasing for 5-6 days that just ended up staying in the buck brush and staying in there and tightening up his program. But he jumped my string at 56. He was in his bed. I snuck in with the cameraman. It was a long stalk in and around him. He had he's a 3x4 frame, and then he had two cheaters on his fronts inside that Palmation, like the G4. Just a great buck, like 190s, big frame on him. And yeah, I had him in his bed, snuck into 56, and I whispered to my cameraman with my mouth, and I said, okay, we're going to shoot him right here, you know?
Yeah.
And he said something back to me, like, where is he at or something. He couldn't see him through the branches. And I looked back down, and then that buck staring right up at me.
Oh.
So he was in his bed looking away, and then now he's staring at me. We had a 5-minute stare off. I didn't move a muscle, and then he started to escape, and he started to go, and I was able to, I had a range on him, able to draw back. We were able to get him in frame, and I've got the video on my phone. I'll show you. Pull, 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 and execute, and that arrow leaves my bow, and he is out of the way by the time that arrow gets there, missed behind his butt.
Completely
by the
gone.
Time he rolls. Yeah, completely missed him. Just a heartbreaker. I'd been hunting him for 5 days or something.
Ouch.
And so he ended up disappearing in the buck brush, and never got another chance at him. And eventually I had to make the tough decision that I got to move. Like, I'm not going to be able to kill this deer, and ended up killing a great, really old 3-point that scored really good, really heavy, really happy with him. But yeah, that one broke my heart like so many over the years. So yeah, I've definitely messed up encounters. Any mistake you can make bow hunting, I've made it.
What's the most common reason that you think you missed?
Common reason nowadays or back in the day? Back in the day.
Maybe both. And how do you
back in the day, I think excitement level and adrenaline. Uh-huh. And, you know, I was a good shot on targets, but transitioning to being a good shot on animals is a different beast. And I think nowadays when I missed, it's like details. It's like, oh, I didn't see that branch, or oh, that buck jumped my string, or I had a range on him and he took a couple steps. It's all in those little details now, as I have my execution pretty well dialed. But nowadays they seem to fall to my arrow more so than not. You can always have a buck move out of the way of the string, and I can always miss one too. But back in the day, I think it was excitement. Now I think it's in the details.
Yeah, all the little things.
Yeah, I like factoring for wind drift, you know, being able to lean into the wind a little bit, and maybe I didn't lean in far enough so nowadays I think the devil's in the details. But yeah, back in the day, I think it was excitement. Like, I thought for a while I had an adrenaline problem, that I got more adrenaline than everybody else because I couldn't calm down and make the shots consistently. So it's taken years to kind of hone that and harness that. But yeah, now I feel real confident when I get a chance at him, that my arrow is going to hit its mark as long as he waits on the arrow.
Do you still get buck fever?
I think so. Yeah, I still get excited. I think I'm able, it's less of a car crash nowadays. I'm able to keep keep cognizant thoughts. I'm able to keep present in that moment. I'm able to breathe deep where I'm not shaken so much. And then I've executed 10,000 shots throughout the year. It's like, it's like walking to shoot my bow and to shoot an accurate arrow. So I try to stay present in that moment. But yeah, I still get super excited. For sure. I think I'm just able to control it better.
Do you have specific thought process? Do you have exercises that you do to help you that you go to? Do you do breathing exercises? Are you like mindful in that moment to like, I need to do this to control myself?
Yep. Deep breaths for sure. Slowing down. Yeah, try to take some deep breaths and slow my heart rate down a little bit. And then I just try to stay focused on the task at hand, like getting that shot on that animal. And I stay present in my execution. So similar to like what Joel Turner teaches, like I execute like a back tension shot where I pull on that critter and execute a good shot. So I know if I execute a good shot, he's going to die. And I just came to the point where I had missed enough animals or had messed up enough. It's like, I'm not going to shoot unless I'm going to hit that animal. And so it's almost like a mindset.
That's hard to do.
It is.
There's a lot of self-control involved in that.
Yep. And I've just realized too that you have more time than you think, and that I don't need to blow up this encounter for a long bomb or a long shot or I can just continue to play the game. Keeping the element of surprise is huge for me, but yeah, I think just a few breaths, staying present in my shot, like talking myself through my shot, seems to really help. And then practicing a lot of high pressure moments, whether it's shooting in front of people or shooting with buddies and then shooting 3D and then eventually shooting at animals. I've been able to transition my good shooting on targets to good shooting on animals, where I execute my very best shot on these animals. And it's worked well for me throughout the years.
Yeah, I mean, I've had to come up with, you know, breathing. So like, I've got to get my breath under control. So I've gone to like, if I can see a shot developing, I've had to register it. And hey, I need to take like in and out 3 or 4 real deep breaths, slow my heart rate down, try to collect my thoughts. And
you got an adrenaline problem like me.
Oh, I've got a bad one. very bad.
Yeah, I think the more encounters you get too, the more comfortable you get. And so if I can get some hunts under my belt, like I hunt Hawaii and I'll usually hunt that in July and August, get chances at axis deer and mouflon and kind of get that adrenaline up. I always have an antelope hunt. I love chasing them with my bow. And so I get some close encounters, or that first big muley of the year tends to get me going. But then I'm just hunting. Then I'm making plays and it comes easier that way. Like having those encounters where you don't put all this pressure on this one encounter. So by the time muley season and elk season get here, I'm pretty comfortable being inside bow range and executing shots. And so I think that helps as well.
Yeah.
That was one thing I wanted to touch on, like how important you guys think it is to hunt other species. Like obviously we all love to hunt mule deer and elk, but like to hunt other animals to prepare for those other situations, like get better at killing by hunting other animals. Like I think it's a lot of people don't do that. In a lot of
you sense. Want an honest confession? All right. So confession, I've kind of become a whitetail nut. And part of it is there's a lot of opportunity with whitetails. And in our region, there's actually a lot of opportunities for it. And so, one of the things that's been fun about doing this with whitetails is that because you have them in front of you and there's so many animals that come in front of you, you have the opportunity to get behind the gun and you sit and you breathe and you have time, and it forces you to learn patience, because the way, especially whitetails in the rut, the way they're working on a field or they're coming in and out really quick, you have to get very good at calming your nerves, because you might have 10 shot opportunities, but they're 2 seconds. And so you have to be able to do it really fast, and you have to be able to keep your nerves together, because you can get really excited real quick. Because like with a mule deer, you may only get one chance.
Yeah.
But with, you know, with a whitetail buck, he might come onto that field 10 different times at 10 different points. And you just can't lose your mind, you know, because it's fast. You don't have like where a mule deer is just standing there, you know, sniffing the wind, moving slow out of the trees, where you get lots of opportunity there. A whitetail buck doesn't operate like that. They move really fast. And so it's forced me to learn how to take quick shot windows. And to be able to manage, there's emotion that comes in too. You know, it's, there's, you know, 'cause you're thinking about it. And then the other side of it is like, I've had to adjust. Part of this came because of the bad winter, like just to be 100% candid. So I'm looking for more opportunities, want to fill my freezer. Where am I going to put my effort? And so it's forced me to be more patient and to learn different levels of patience. It's forced me to learn how to move slower. I'll say this. I've looked at a lot of data on non-resident hunters. I don't know their trophies. You don't always get their trophy data. Some of these states don't report it, you know, different things like that. But when you look at non-resident success, a lot of them are more successful, like overall, like because either A, they just feel like they have to kill something on the way out. Okay, that's a factor. Okay, yep. I'm not. but they're also a lot more patient. There were these guys from Minnesota that I ran into. This is when I was low 20s, so I was a young guy. You know, you're still, when you're in your 20s, you have a lot more go than you have experience. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of times your go make you kill a lot of things because you got a lot of go. Yeah. But you don't,
you make a lot of mistakes too because yes. you have a lot of go.
Exactly. Yeah. And so I'm hiking this logging road and I see these five guys from Minnesota walking out and they've got a bull elk on their back. It was a small six, wasn't a giant, you know, mm-hmm. but it was back when he was easy to draw a general tag in Wyoming. And so they had a group that applied every single year after we found out that we're talking with them for a while and found out that they pretty consistently killed in this area all the time. But when the hunting was slow, like, and this is October 15th to the 20th type of hunt, so it's not optimal time for elk hunting. Done on purpose by Wyoming Game and Fish so that it doesn't get overhunted.
Sure.
But what they did is they had spots where they knew to sit. They had travel. They hunted them just like a whitetail.
Yeah.
And they did it patient, you know, and they outpatiented me. Like, I was walking into the end of this logging road, going up the hill, looking for a spot to go look, you know, the same spot. I didn't see elk every single time I went in. You know, I think I had a memory of seeing an elk there one time as a kid, you know, so that adaptability like we had talked about. But that patience that some of those guys from back east have an advantage because they're way more patient than a lot of us Western guys.
And hunt to your strengths. I tell people that a lot too. Some people are just more patient than others. They can sit for days and days. Some people are really sneaky and stealthy and have a lot of patience in that. So I tell people that all the time, like hunt to your strengths, figure out what it is that you're good at. Like if you have really good intuition on where an animal might be and when, you know, ambush hunting can be really good. So just try to figure out what it is that you're good at and, and hunt that way.
Yeah, I think bow hunting different species and different environments sharpens my skill set in different ways and makes me a great overall bow hunter. Yep. And the way I learned to be a good bow hunter was to get a lot of experience. And so stalking whitetail does in the river bottom, antelope's a great way. Like, you know, you may get, you know, two or three stalks during the whole mule deer season, but I can get two or three stalks on antelope a day and they're really sharp in that open terrain. Mm-hmm. So it made me better at stalking. And so for me, experience is a great teacher, the best teacher. Mm-hmm. And so I'm trying to take on as many bow hunts as I can fit in my calendar and fitting those high opportunity hunts. Like some of these places I hunt mule deer, they might not get the biggest there. They're prairie mule deer and a big mature 5, 6, 7 year old deer is 160 inches. Yep. But he doesn't know his rack is 160 inches. He knows he's an old deer that survived in the prairie for years, and he's going to take a really sharp skill set from a bow hunter to be able to kill him. So that's where I'll match wits with bucks out there that are high opportunity and get chances and try to harvest that older age class. And I think these high opportunity hunts really help create like a better bow hunter. And then hunting mule deer all over, hunting them from the desert floor to the mountaintops, to the breaks, to the prairies, to the foothills, all these different places you have to go in. And a huge skill set is just being able to find these animals.
Yeah.
So if I can dissect these units, if I can figure out where these animals are residing, be able to pick them up, create opportunities, I can then carry that skill set into my next hunt or into the one after that. And like spring bear, like Brady loves to hunt spring bear and is a huge fan of bear hunting, as am I. Now, bear hunting, they can smell 7 times what a bloodhound can. And a bloodhound can track somebody that was kidnapped out of the scent that comes out the vent of their car when it's driving down the road. So a bear can smell it. Like if you get busted, it was probably the wind with a bear. So it's made me really good at dissecting mountain winds, thermals, and directionals, having this higher understanding of a wind. And where does that come into play? When I'm trying to kill a 7x7 bull, or when I'm trying to kill a 190 inch buck that I found, now I have this higher understanding of the wind. And so like hunting these different species in these different environments, they sharpen your skills just to make you a better overall bow hunter. So it kind of goes back to like what we started talking about being successful is like developing these instincts. So it's really helped me to answer your question, Brady, throughout the years, a lot of hunting experience.
Yeah. Like, I'm glad you touched on bears. Bears are such a cool animal. But like even hunting bears and like glassing bears, becoming a better glasser, becoming better at, again, patience of sitting on the mountain, because I think bear hunting and mule deer hunting is so very, very similar. I mean, I do it with a rifle, you do it with a bow, but like I still think it's a lot similar. Like the patience trying to find something, trying to find one that's old. It's very hard to find an old mature mule deer, hard to find an old mature bear, and like all the tactics are kind of same similar weather. It's like, you know, nasty in the spring, nasty in the fall, like pretty good time out there to get.
That's why we get along so good, Brady. We like the same thing.
I think so. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Gal, I want to go back real quick. So making a shot.
Yeah.
I've been, you brought up earlier, I've been doing a lot of target shooting. So I've been listening to a lot of sports psychology, like podcasts and stuff. And, I'm going to share some stuff I wrote down. I try to read this every time before I start shooting in the morning. I start shooting games, and I'm interested if any of this resonates with you and if you do any of this. So this individual said, visualization, specifically visualize with all five senses in a third person, like you're watching yourself on a screen. Mm. They said is more impactful. Have you ever?
God, I love that. I love visualizations. Like, yep. I used to do it in wrestling a ton before matches.
Yep.
And I don't do it with my target shooting. Now, maybe I should, or I can implement that. But I do. I think of my big hunts, and almost on a daily basis, I close my eyes and I picture that buck walking out and giving me a broadside. Maybe he's on edge. And so when I get in those situations, I feel like I've been there before, and I visualize myself drawing back, talking to myself, executing a shot on that animal. And I think it really helps. Like, you're never going to visualize that exact scenario, but you visualize every single day of killing that buck or bull. Yeah. And when you're in that position, you just seem to be more comfortable, less erratic. Like, I think the biggest mistake people make when shooting at animals is they put the pin where it goes and boom, the shot's off. They just don't give time for that pin to settle or to move. The difference between a bad and a good shot is less than a second. Mm-hmm. It's just letting that pin settle and pulling on that shot until it breaks, like instead of just forcing the pin there and going now and trying to get that shot to break really quick. Like, that was when I'd run into bad scenarios. The arrow doesn't go exactly where I want it to, or I miss a critter. And so just that little bit of slowing down, I think visualization really helps that.
I thought it was interesting. This podcast I've been listening to, visualize with all five senses. So what does it smell like? What does it feel like? What are you hearing?
Oh, I love that.
Like getting into the
detail. I don't do that.
Okay. So I'm just going to be honest. I played hockey growing up. And this whole sports psychology, I don't want to smell that ever again. That was terrible, man.
Really?
I'm not going there. Oh, it was bad. It was brutal.
Yeah, that's interesting.
So I can, it's bringing up the memory right now.
Another little tidbit that I gathered from this that I thought was interesting. So this, they said specifically for practice sessions, remove the emotion from a bad shot, celebrate a good shot. So you make a bad shot, remove the emotion from it, but celebrate a good shot. Pat yourself on the back for the good ones, forget the bad ones instantaneously, and over time, it'll develop into a more confident, and they talk a lot about confidence. Which I thought was really interesting.
That's super interesting. You got to get me this podcast you're listening to, but confidence kills.
Oh,
and,
for sure.
And on a target, you know, I haven't heard that before, and I don't know that I practice it exactly that way, but yeah, if I make a bad shot, it's like move on to the next one. Mm-hmm. You know, it's you can't have that arrow back. I don't know that I celebrate my good arrows, but I do, like when I execute a good shot and it goes right where I wanted to, right in the middle, man, that feels good.
Like, yeah, it does.
I think executing a good shot on an animal is as much as the trophy is killing the animal. I love that control over my mind to be able to execute and make a perfect shot on an animal and watch him go over and tip over. It's like I've just conquered the world, but that's as much the trophy to me as the animal that I've harvested.
We've talked about this among ourselves on the podcast before. There's animals that I've killed that are great animals that I did not make a great controlled shot. And I feel differently about that experience than an animal that I did make a great shot and I knew it.
Same.
I feel very different levels of satisfaction about that experience.
There's a bull I killed in 2015. 330-yard shot. He moved just slightly. So I was going to put it right in the heart, but he moved just slightly and got him in the elbow. Mm. Like, so it still went in. He was going to die. But that allowed him to turn, and so I had to take another shot, which was even harder, where I'm trying to, you're aiming down and you're hitting vitals, but I'm shooting into the back to go down, you know, get both, clip both lungs on the way through. That was harder, and so that wasn't, you know, that wasn't a cakewalk to get that done. And so we saw him fall, but we had grizzly bears on the ridge behind us, so we turned around.
The dinner bell's going off and those gunshots going out.
That is, you know, it's a whole... There's a whole story to that too. So, but by the time we dealt with the grizzly bears yelling and screaming at them, I turned around
And he'd gotten back up and ran over. And I'm like, where did he go? And we found him. And I still ended up even putting two bullets into him. Like, I still had to finish him off. But that's the experience. Instead of, if I'd taken just one more second on this shot, it would have been a much better experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So.
Yeah, it is interesting, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
it's the same super outcome, but it just feels different.
It does feel different, and it's not a perfect world. And sometimes you get a hit, and it's out of your control. But you just want to do everything that's in your control to make a good shot. And then there's times where you got to make a follow up shot or track it, or you just need to do what needs to be done. It's not a perfect world, but boy, it feels good when it goes perfect, though.
Yeah, it's the best.
Yeah, it's the best.
It's the most engaging. It's perfect. Those are the ones they go back to, right? Think about them, never forget them. I'll hit you with the last one. So the last one says, be free of the outcome. And it's mainly in the mindset that I think I'd be interested in you. Are you, when you're in a stock and everything is working perfectly, the animal's right there in your mind, are you like, oh, I'm taking field photos already? Do you do that?
I have before. I think now there's been enough of them that get away from me and enough things that can go wrong even in a perfect scenario that I try not to get too excited or count my chickens before they hatch. There's something interesting falling in love with the process and not the outcome, I think is so important. Yeah. And so I'm in love with the process of bow hunting, the preparing for it, the executing shots. Like I love every piece of it, and I try to work at every piece of it to be at my very best. And so I think falling in love with the process of bow hunting instead of the results is like really important, like doing it for the right reasons. And so I think when you find that, like that's what makes a good hunter is like you love the whole experience, the whole process, the being in nature, the adventure part, the grind of it, the being tired, the whole experience you enjoy, whether you're successful or not. And I think when you fall in love with that process, success finds you.
Yeah, I think you nailed it. That's exactly it. You fall in love with the outcome and you get so preoccupied with the outcome. Like, I am going to kill this giant deer, but you miss all the steps, you lose patience and persistence and the things that really matter that yield that outcome. So like if I'm trying to shoot a 300 Vegas game and I think I'm going to shoot a 300 today, like I'm already above and beyond what I should be thinking about. Cause the only thing that should be in my mind is like the next step, setting my feet, getting my grip, you know what I mean? Leveling my bubble, sight housing, peep, pin, pull. There's like all those little things that I think you skip by when you, and I'm guilty of this. Like I get real outcome driven and preoccupied in my thought.
Yeah. It's what helps drive me is for these outcomes. And I love big critters and challenging myself, but really it's like the love of the game. And as we all get older, you start to realize that these adventures, being on them, having the challenge out in front of you is what's really enjoyable. Yeah. And now that I've harvested quite a few animals, like I don't need to kill one to prove to myself or prove to anybody else I'm a good bow. So like I just try to immerse myself in that experience and just enjoy it fully. Like I don't have to work. I've got 10 days free. My family's taken care of. Like all I have is to be immersed in this hunt, trying to kill this deer, the challenge of it, trying to put on the miles, trying to find him. And I think that's what I really love about it. Yeah.
Can I, people would be upset if I didn't ask you. I wanted to talk to you about bow and arrow setup. What are you shooting?
Mm-hmm.
I have here in my notes tuning. So like what's your tuning process? And I have here, what are the details that most podcast or video content gloss over? Like what are those things that you think maybe you do that maybe you haven't talked about or you don't generally hear on a podcast?
Yeah. So I think it's just putting in the time and gaining the knowledge with these bows. I think it can be a bit of a black magic. So I think the deeper you dive down the rabbit hole and the more you learn, the more you problem solve with these bows, the better you're going to be. So just knowing my weapon inside and out, similar to you with a bow, similar to you and your rifle, you know everything about it. Mm-hmm. And that's the same way with the bow. And so I'm shooting the Lift X, pretty standard setup, fall away release. I've got a black gold, a scent. which is a 5-pin mover. I like to have the multi pins, and then I use my bottom pin as a mover. Seems to work really well for me. The tuning process for me, I really take my time nowadays. And so, you know, I get that bow, and I guess just to walk through it, like, I want to find the center between the two cams, where I'm going to tie in my knocking point. You know, so I really try to find the center, because if you have it a little high or a little low, you're getting more force out of one of those cams or the other. I then time the cams so they're firing at the same time. I set my arrow exactly down the center shot of the bow, which most of the time is 13/16 to the center of the shaft from the edge of the riser. But I really like to look at the bow, and I like to look at the limb bolts, and I like to look at my stabilizer coming out, make sure that that arrow is going true and straight down the power path of the string, right in the center of both the top and bottom cams, and then I'll kind of tune the bow to get a good rip through paper. And I'm bare shaft tuning from 5 feet, and then from 20 feet, I'm shooting my fletchings through 5 feet, through 20 feet, and it's not just one day. It's multi-day process for me, is shooting through paper, wearing in the strings, back to paper, make sure that arrow is coming off that bow true. I think for me, the thing that makes me good at archery is I'm willing to progress as an archer, and to do that, to make changes in my form is really difficult. When you make changes in your form, you get a little bit worse, and then you improve and you get better than you were before. Mm-hmm. But it's tough to get worse.
For sure.
It's tough to have something that doesn't feel familiar. And so even this year, you know, I've been shooting a bow for 20 some years and shoot one really accurately. This year, I'm working with my grip a little bit.
Yeah,
just scooted my grip over just a little bit and touching my fingers to the front end of that bow. And I'm getting more of a consistent shot, and I'm seeing it in my scores and in my paper, and it's such a minor tweak to my grip, and I had a good grip before, but I'm willing to make these changes to be a better archer than I was last season, really building my base, you know, shooting a lot of arrows like I shoot every single day, and right now I'm building my base of a lot of arrows and building back up my muscles, building back up my endurance. But yeah, I really get in depth with the tuning process, the sight tape I want so dialed. But I want it dialed for my broadheads, not my field points, you know? And the broadheads seem to start dropping off a yard at 80, 2 yards at 100. Now, I'm not shooting at critters out there, but I want that thing so dialed. If I need a follow-up shot, or if I need to make a shot on an animal, I have a cut downhill, I want to know exactly where it's going. Cuts downhill, shooting downhill shots. Like, I've, you know, the rangefinders are great. The angle compensations are great. Like, you got to make it work for your bow as well. And I notice as I start getting to angles, I got to knock another yard off, or the six hour, which I know you guys use. They build great rangefinders, which you can put the speed of your bow in that rangefinder to be exactly dialed. But you got to go proof it. You got to go shoot it. You got to make sure your third axis is on. You got to know everything about that weapon, because every successful hunt will come down to making a shot. So if you know that bow intimately, inside and out, you're just going to be better prepared to make that shot when crunch time comes.
What are you shooting for stabilizers? Links.
Oh, so I'm shooting the Cutter stabilizers, which is great. It's Earl Stroll came up with these stabilizers a few years ago. They're carbon fiber. They're really strong. So I shoot a 15 out front, and I shoot a 12 out back of my sidebar. I shoot more weight than most guys. I shoot 10 ounces in the back. I shoot 6 ounces in the front. So I'm adding a pound to this bow, but it's just like every hunt comes down to making a shot, and I want that pin float to be small out there. And it's like the more weight you add, the slower your aim gets and the smaller your aim gets. So I shoot more weight than most guys, but it's really balanced well on my bow when I draw back. And also carrying my bow, it doesn't pull front or back. It's really well balanced in and through there. So, you know, Earl wanted to send me a 20-inch stabilizer. I said, don't even put that thing in my head, because 15 and 12 is max for me. And I know a longer stabilizer is going to hold better, but I found my max of what I can stock with, what I can hunt with, what's going to hold good, what has a good reaction to the bow. So I probably shoot more weight than most guys.
See all that passion there? That was.
Oh, yeah, I love that.
You have a good relationship with your bow.
I do. We're best friends. Yeah, for sure.
There's nothing like it. What about you, Scott? Are you more rifle guy?
I'm a rifle guy. Like, I shoot a bow. I'm an opportunist. If there's an opportunity to go hunt, I'm just going to take it.
You pick up a muzzleloader if you need to or anything?
Whatever I have to. If there's an opportunity. I've never done a muzzleloader hunt. Just, it's, you know, fun. Full disclosure.
It's addiction.
I want to, but I... the way our season structure and the way we plan hunts, the way we film hunts, and I end up on a lot of those, it rifles what I end up on. Mm-hmm. And I really enjoy it. The biggest game changer in the last while has been how easy it is to get a suppressor. Now it has changed the game. I'll use this as an example. I've got a Savage 110 carbon barrel, and I've got a Banish 30 from Silencer Central on it. But my dad, he's had a pretty bad jerk as he's gotten older. Mm-hmm. It fixed it because it took all of that away. So
yeah, you're not scared behind
them. He's not scared by it. And so it completely modifying, because, you know, you can put a brake on and it can scare people. Mm-hmm. You know, that just happens. But even though it takes away the recoil, but that's been a game changer. But I want to pat Brian on the back on something that he's really passionate about. You heard all his setup. But the biggest thing I would say is watching, because we talk, what, once a week usually? Mm-hmm. You know, his consistency. Mm-hmm. You know, like, if he's not doing it regularly, it doesn't matter. And it doesn't matter what we shoot, what, you know, what weapon it is. If you're not consistent and you're not mm-hmm. in the field, I see you're social all the time. You're out shooting all the time, mm-hmm. you know, and so that makes a huge difference. If you're not practicing in the field, you're not going to make a difference. There are so many guys I know that can't shoot a rifle unless they're prone.
Yeah.
Well, I shot a mule deer at 488 yards sitting. You know, mm-hmm. it's a tall bipod. Mm-hmm. I will not shoot, like, at an animal, I just won't shoot past 500. That's yeah. my line. I'm not the police on this. You know, we can have long range discussions. Okay. Same comments. Oh, yeah, we do. You guys can relate. No, exactly. I'm not the police on it, but I just won't. That's just my my personal line for whatever reasons there are. And but I'll take a rifle out to 1,000 yards. Like, it's the modern rifle, many of them are just so good that now if you have the tools, you can make a 1,000-yard gun. If you can't do it in a week, you're, mm-hmm. you know, you need to adjust what you're doing, or, you know, and there are some guns out there that they don't shoot well. You can buy a lemon, it happens, but it's very rare that you can't find a load and you can't find a round. And, you know, we've been using the Hornady factory ammunition for so long, it's gotten so good that, yeah, I used to reload, but I hardly have to anymore. It's mm-hmm. very rare for me to find a gun where we have to work through reloading and go through the entire process. But, you know, within a week, we can get a rifle out to 1,000 yards. I can have it dialed in. I've got a SIG Whiskey 5 on just about everything that I've got. And dial. I still use the dial. I have not been converted to the BDX. Part of mm-hmm. it is I always feel so gray reading regulations on, is this legal or exactly, is it not? Yeah,
the same way.
And I'm like, I don't want to get beat up on that deal, mm-hmm. you know. So, so that's kind of how that works for me is, but the consistency, and Brian's one of the most consistent humans, whether it's on anything, whether it's spending time with family, whether it's practicing with his bow, whether I know on Tuesday mornings, I am getting an email somewhere in the morning before 10 o'clock that he has his podcast ready. Mm-hmm. Like every Tuesday morning it happens. It's consistency mm-hmm. in all facets of life that makes him good at what he does. And that allows him, being consistent allows him to make those little things. Sure, you can get into the minutia, but if you're not shooting your bow or you're not shooting your rifle on a regular basis, mm-hmm. you may as well not be doing it. Or you better be shooting like with a rifle and don't take anything further than 200 if you're not practicing. That's just simple reality. Yeah. The further out, the harder the math is on making a good shot.
I see you guys putting in the work. Yeah, it's Brady. You know your rifles, your muzzle loaders inside just, and out. And I see you messing with that bow quite a bit lately here too. And Trail, you were all in on archery, and we're all good enough to go out next season and go kill something with our bow or with our rifle. But the deal is, when you're a student of the game or you're trying to be at your best and you know how difficult these animals are, I want to give myself the best chance when I find 190 or 200 incher, my best chance to kill that thing. And for me, it's hard work, consistency, it's discipline. And so I'm just continuing to learn and trying to get better so I can be good in those moments, the same as you guys. We are good enough to phone it in and kill an animal, but that's not what we're looking to do.
Yeah, we want that perfect every single time and want to be ready for it.
I want it to be. It's not always, but you know. Yeah. No, I think it's interesting. So like there's different different pieces and, you know, parts of hunting that make a person successful. There's like all these little facets, and some people are better at, you know, the fitness, physical fitness side of it. Some people are better at e-scouting and scouting in general. Some people are like really gravitate to shooting or, you know, whatever it is. I think you have to do all of it to be like really consistent. But I would say like, if there is a part or a piece of that, that you really just gravitate towards, like do that to death. And then, try to do as much as you can across the board, but really for me, I love shooting my bow. So like, I would do that regardless, you know, whether I bow hunted or not. But yeah, I would just say, guess that would be my advice. Find the thing that you love and really go at it.
Yep. And work on your weaknesses. And
work on your weaknesses.
Yeah. It's like, I love the way you explain that. Mm-hmm. And I think about it the same way. It's so multifaceted and all these skill sets to be successful. But yeah, if you have a strength in shooting and you're really good at shooting, like that gives you an advantage in the field. Or if you're really good at stalking, that gives you an advantage. Or really good at finding animals and creating encounters through your e-scouting, through your glassing. So there's all these skill sets that are out there. And I think you need to be working on each of them. But you're right, when you have a strength, you hone in on it and use that to your advantage. And then when you find a weakness, you know, work on that weakness. And
it's just harder to work on your weaknesses. It's just not as enjoyable, right? Because it's not the thing that you love. So I would say, in order to like maintain and like continue to get better across the board, do the thing that you love, do it more, but you've also got to find time to like work on your weaknesses too. And you have to, I mean, you're everything that I know of you, everything that Scott's explained of you, you're a very self-disciplined person. And I think you have to be if you want to really do well at it. You got to develop some real self-discipline to work at it.
One of the hardest self-disciplines is, if you want to be good at something, you have to give up something else.
Sure. That's hard.
But it's true. I'll use this as an example. I love being an outdoorsman. But in order to kill big mule deer, I had to give up a lot of archery elk hunting opportunity because where I grew up, where I spent a lot of time, is historically open September 15th. Best points in the rut for elk hunting, September 15th.
That's why I've got deer points all over everywhere, because I keep hunting elk every September.
Elk are so thrilling, man. They're so fun. It's tough for me to pick a favorite.
I gave it up. I wanted to learn how to tie flies. I realized in my mid-20s that, well, I want to kill big mule deer. If I want to do that, the best time to be fly fishing is end of July through August in a lot of high mountain streams. Well, guess what I should be doing then if I want to find a big mule deer?
Should be out scouting.
Exactly. Boots on the ground. You have to give up certain things. And then, you know, like, I'm married. I've got 4 kids. So if that's the case, I have to hone in what I want to be good at in order so that I can have, like Brian talked about, all those other pieces. And it's hard to have a conversation with yourself and say, okay, I can only do so much, but I'd rather be good at these 3 or 4 things. But that, when you learn how to identify what do I want to be good at, that allows you to say, instead of going at it from, okay, I've identified this as a weakness, turn it into, what do I want to be good at? You know, like, so I picked hunting and my guitar. They're my 2 hobbies. So I had to, playing guitar requires a level of patience. Like, there's a lot of people that can just strum. Okay. You can play 4 chords, you can move a capo, that sort of thing. But if you want to be good at it and learn how to finger pick, that requires patience and precision, much like building a load for a rifle. So all these things translate.
Fletching an arrow.
Yes. I'm terrible at fletching arrows. It takes a lot of work.
There goes 4 hours of your day. Gone. Yeah,
more than that. It takes a whole day. But yeah.
Got to have ammo.
Yeah. You got to.
So, but deciding I want to be good at this and, you know, and so if I want to be good at this, understand there's room for growth. I don't like to call them weaknesses all the time. I say, I want to be good at this.
That's something that I'm
like, cause it flips it in your brain.
Yeah, mindset.
And so I want to be good at such and such skill, and it's, you know, you only have so much time, you know, life dictates that. And, you know, I've said this before, at the end of the day, it's going to matter a lot more that my boys are coming with me hunting. And, you know, my girls are starting to already, but my boys come with me some, but the experiences that we're going to have together and memories with dad, I want to translate all those skills, but I want to actually be good at it, not learning it at the same time they are. Translate that, teach that. But again, it's, I want to be a good dad, tie that into the skills that I already have in hunting, and you know, it all ties together.
Are you good at guitar? Should I have to bring it?
I'm Powell, Wyoming good. There's a difference. I am Powell, Wyoming good. I am not Nashville guitar.
You're good, then. It's got to be.
I see a guitar and it looks complicated. So, like, when you explain it right there, it's like, I can see it's like, it does have similarities to setting up a weapon or, you know, e-scouting or doing it. So it's going to take time and you got to devote it to it to be good at it.
Effort. A lot of years. You know,
once you see the pattern in something, you can see it in everything, and it always has similarities. So if you want to be good at bow hunting, if you want to be good at business, if you want to be good at construction, if you like it, it takes like the same dedication to it and discipline. But yeah, you can be good at anything if you set your mind to it, and there's enough information out there nowadays. So if you want to be a good hunter, like, the opportunity is out there. The bucks and bulls of our dreams still exist out there. You can still go find your own experience, your own adventure. It's just real difficult, and you're not going to get good at it in a day, a week, a month, a year. This is like a lifelong journey. Yep. And, you know, all of us guys sitting in this room have been working at it for 20 years to get to where we're at, or longer, to try to build these skill sets to show up at a trailhead and expect to be successful on a giant deer or on a giant bull. And it doesn't always come together. But I think that commitment level and continuing to put in the work, like, eventually you get to where you want to go.
Yeah,
you expect it.
Yeah,
and you have the backing to expect it, the confidence.
That's right.
I have some rapid fire questions. Do you have other questions?
No, I was going to ask if we're going to do the rapid fire.
Yeah, do you guys want some rapid fire questions?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay,
some of these are really good. By the way, I got a little tease earlier. Just going to put that out there.
Toughest animal to hunt for each of you, to bow hunt, to rifle hunt.
I've hunted some really tough animals and really challenging, but pound for pound, day in, day out, an old mule deer just is the toughest animal to harvest for me. And they're the ones that make me question my sanity, but also I get the most enjoyment out of. But a big mule deer, and he acts different than a 3-year-old mule deer, a 4-year-old mule. I'm talking like a 7, 8, 9-year-old mule deer. Yep. Mm-hmm. Man, pound for pound, those things are crafty, and they've evolved thousands of years from avoiding mountain lions, which are way sneakier than I am. They give me the most challenge. And then I do everything right, and he jumps the string, you know? Like, they'll break your heart as well. Yeah. But yeah, I'd say pound for pound, a mule deer.
Yep. Old
mature buck.
Okay. Sometimes I'm making everybody mad. Elk are stupid.
You heard it.
There's a bunch of noisy fat boys.
Yes, exactly. I've been saying this for years. Like, now, I will
not a giant. Like, there's some true giants that are mind blowing. Okay, I'll make the argument.
You got to beat all the cows' you have all these eyeballs with these herd dynamics trying to kill a big bull, too. Yeah, so I'm with you.
We could have a little debate here because I know of a bull. I brought it up last time on the podcast. This bull was a 380 bull, probably a 7, 8-year-old bull. I think it took another 4 years for somebody to kill that bull. And the only way they killed that bull is they killed him on the sportsman's tag year-round season after the season dates. But nobody could find and kill that bull. I would make the argument that they're actually smarter because they're larger, they're easier to see, and they're vocal. And yet, nobody could kill that bull.
What rolls?
Mic drop.
What rolls around in the mud? Pigs and elk.
Okay. No, but I agree with you. An old bow hunting, that's been my experience. Yeah. A big mature mule deer is so hard to kill.
So hard.
So hard. Did you like that one?
I like that one.
Mm-hmm. All right. Fixed or mechanical broadheads or favorite caliber?
Yeah, mechanical. I like the damage they do. So they're just more forgiving. They're more forgiving in flight, which it's all about accuracy and where you hit. You hit the vitals and they die, and if you don't, you got a 10% chance to get them. Mm-hmm. But the deal is with an expandable, it does more damage. So if you hit the edge of the vitals, if you miss the vitals, if that buck moves forward and you get them where it's not in the vitals, you're making a bigger cut, doing more damage, better opportunity to recover that animal. So for me, I've been using mechanicals for the last 15-20 years on every species, from elk to moose to mule deer to bears so I just like the damage an expandable does, and I like the flight characteristics, as I think it's more accurate. And so for me, it's expandable all the way.
Accuracy over penetration?
I like both.
I like both too.
Yeah. I shoot a really short draw length, 26 and a half, 70 pounds. I have no problem getting pass-throughs on elk with expandables. Okay. So I don't really worry about the penetration so much. I mean, I'm not going to shoot a 2.5-inch expandable or something that's made like a whitetail fury or something like that on an elk. I'm definitely going to shoot a smaller size expandable that gets good penetration. Yep. But I get plenty of penetration. And, you know, I think if you're talking a pass-through with a fixed blade, or if you're talking just an entrance with an expandable, I'll take just that entrance with an expandable.
In the right spot.
in the right spot for sure.
I concur. Favorite caliber?
Until a few years ago, I would have said 30 caliber.
Oh man, you and Brady get along great.
But hold on, we're about to break up, Brady.
yes.
I have fallen in love with a 6.5 PRC.
Yeah.
So that the whole package, not just you know, not just the caliber, but the cartridge. I've fallen in love with it, and for a variety of reasons, I'm going to try it on an elk at some point.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to...
You know your limitations, at least, with it. That's what's nice. You're smart enough to know.
Yeah. It's not like the 300 Win Mag where you can just, you know, just keep pounding until you knock it down. Elk can take a lot. You know, the square or the pound pressure that you can apply to them with a bullet, you know, it's a lot. I've seen, you know, big bulls take 5 or 6 hits and they're still standing there, mm-hmm. you know, and not at long distances where you've lost your velocity. And mm-hmm. so I used to make the argument a lot that with, you know, you can get the bullet weight up with 30 caliber. However, mm-hmm. I'll explain my evolution. I had a rifle that I was still working through some different things. It wasn't a shooter, just to be candid. Very rare for there to be one that wasn't a shooter. So Todd Helms, our editor, he came to me and he's like, well, I've got this 7 mag. It's dialed, take it. So I brought it out to the range and he gave me gave me the card and that had all the dial up information. And so got it. And, you know, I'm okay, confident in this gun. It felt really, the model was exactly the same as my 300 too. So I was able to take it with me and it felt exactly the same. So, but then I started looking into, okay, the 7's bullet density. Okay. All right. I see where you're coming from with this. Mm-hmm. And so with the 7 PRC and the 6.5 PRC and those, that coming around and then looking at the 6.5 PR, I'm just gonna say another controversial thing. The 6.5 PRC is what everybody hoped the 6.5 Creedmoor was.
I would agree with that.
You know, like, but so once you actually put that horsepower behind the 6.5, mm-hmm. I love it. Mm-hmm. You know, and I've shot it a lot. Like I've been, like I said, I've got a 1,000-yard rifle with it. Putting the can on it, there is zero recoil. So being able to efficiently get ready for a follow up, that's why I like it. Mm-hmm. Whereas it's not gonna. When you get into the bigger, you know, bigger cartridges, you can beat the tar out of yourself. I shot a 300 Weatherby with a muzzle brake for years, and I'm still probably dealing with some trauma from that.
Some PTSD, you know, from it.
Yes.
So rock your world.
It was one of my favorite rifles. My dad gave it to me as a, you know, graduation present from college, but it's still one of those things that I'm going to get a can on that before I ever shoot that again.
Yeah.
So,
camouflage clothing. Does it matter? Does it work?
I think I killed a lot of big stuff in solid colors. I think animals really see the movement far more than they see your camo pattern. So having like good instincts, being able to hold still, I think is the most important. But I've come around to camouflage, and I do think it helps break up my outline at times where a deer will look in my direction or look at me and I don't move, and I think it breaks up my outline enough, which just may gain me that opportunity to put an arrow through him, or he looks at me, but he's almost looking through me. He doesn't see me, and then he puts his head down and he goes back to feeding and kind of breaks up my outline. So I do think in bow hunting, getting close, I think you can kill him with, I mean, heck, I hunt a lot of rifle seasons where I have to wear orange out there, and mm-hmm. I still kill mule sure. deer and bears mm-hmm. wearing orange, so it can obviously be done. But I do like having a camo pattern to really blend mm-hmm. into my environment. And last year, I killed a really good late season buck. His 182 had an extra on him, a great frame on him. Stalking in on a deer on that hunt, it was in snow. And as I was moving, I had a tree in front of me to the deer. Normally, I'd just be able to crawl and I'd be able to get into this tree and I'd be able to shoot that mule deer. And they picked me out because I had a white backdrop and I was moving in between the branches of that tree and they caught my dark outline. So this year, I have over whites for my late season to be able to get close. So I do think it gives me an advantage, but ultimately, it comes down to movement.
Mm-hmm. Yep. But it's an additive that can help.
Yeah, I think so. Yep.
Yeah, gotcha. I agree. It's a good to have.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
This one I'm interested in. So you're headed out for a hunt. What are you listening to in your truck? What's playing? What are you listening to?
Boy, that's a good one.
I've got that queued up.
Okay, go ahead. You answer. Let me think about mine.
Brandon Mason and I started a started a tradition, mostly my tradition, because I went to college in Texas, and so there are more live music places. This will explain the guitar piece me a bit too. So there are more live music places in Austin than there are in Nashville, and so and there's this Texas country red dirt. So there's this guy named Aaron Watson. We started listening to Freight Train as we leave. Yep. And it's kind of funny. I may have fanboyed when we had him on Ike's podcast, you know, a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, so it was kind of fun getting to meet and talk.
Those are always fun.
Yeah. It's fun when you get a personality that you get, you know, and you know, that whole don't meet your heroes sometimes. Mm-hmm. That was not him. He was as down to earth as they come and was fun to be around. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's what I listen to on the way.
Yeah, I think I'm a mix. If I'm getting close to the trailhead, I've got a playlist or, you know, gosh, I love it'll date me a little bit, but like some Tool or
Maynard.
Yeah. And then I love like some bluegrass and I have some CDs that just will bring back this flood of emotions because they remind me a hunt I've been on and I can put in that CD, but also podcasts, self-improvement podcasts, sports podcasts. They don't always have to be a hunting podcast. But yeah, I do like entertainment and listening to podcasts as well. So I'm a mix and match and I don't really have like a go-to answer, but definitely some music as I'm pulling up to the trailhead the last 45 minutes or so to get me amped up for the hike in.
Everybody listening that just heard you say Tool, everybody's picturing the same thing. You got Brian in his pickup and you've got that intro. Yeah. You know, Tool, the real deep one that kind of blends. I can't even think of the song right now. I don't know if I could say it, if I could remember the title, but I guarantee everybody's got this image like Brian's rolling up. He's serious. He means business. He's got Tool going.
That's it.
Yep. I love it. What's one thing you guys hope to be remembered for? Do you guys, you get a little older? Like, I mean, I don't, you're probably in your
41.
You're in your 40s, I would think.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Do you want to be remembered as far as like in the industry, you know, as a father? I mean, what are the important things to you? And specifically, we'll say the outdoors, the hunting. What do you want to be remembered for?
Yeah, I don't really think of remembered as much as I just want to live a full life and do as much as I possibly can while I can. And so I'm just trying to get the most out of my body. I'm trying to get the most out of my time. And so I like love going on these adventures. So for me, it's just, you know, it's looking forward and preparing for the next adventure. And then when I'm on it, like this full 100% immersion of really enjoying the experience, whether I'm successful or not.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I don't really think of it as remembered by, but, you know, I just want to give my all and I want to go on as many adventures as I can, live life to the fullest and enjoy it along the way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think I've been thinking about it more recently. I'm 45, but like I think kind of goes along with what you're saying. But I think about my kids, like what are my kids going to remember of me, you know? And I think I want them to remember that I was passionate about things to the point where I was obsessive.
I like that.
And that I did them with as much passion and as often as I could, and that I was successful in them, and like it was important enough to me that I put a lot of time and attention that I chased them. Like I was passionate about something and that I chased it.
That's a great answer.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love
think
that.
About that quite a bit.
Yeah.
Yeah. You?
So I thought about this a lot. Like we've had a lot of conversations about this because one of the unique things about working at Eastman's is 1987.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, we're working for a legacy brand.
Yeah.
We listen to a lot of the Ramsey and Ramsey podcasts and things like that. Mm-hmm. And so Dave Ramsey talks a lot about the legacy phase. Mm-hmm. And so it's really cool to get to talk about that. But that's spurred a lot of conversations like in the office, you know, Brandon, Ike, myself. Nothing says more about me and everything about me than the way my kids turn out.
Hmm.
And so for me, I want them to look at what I did inside this space, you know, inside that hopefully, you know, everything comes to an end at some point. Mm-hmm. So at some point, either I'll retire or life changes or whatever, you know, I've had this conversation where everything changes at some point. So when I leave what I am doing now for Eastman's, did I leave it better? Did I leave it in a spot where that legacy is going to continue? Mm-hmm. You know, so same with my kids, you know, same with my family. We're really active in our church. Same with the things we do in our church. All those pieces, you know, am I going to leave a legacy that's there? I didn't think about that a lot in my 20s. I didn't have kids. I started having kids, you know, in my 30s. And so that now that I've gotten that and I can see that. And then the other thing is my daughter's old enough now where I can see that she's evaluating my life. You know, there's this point where you go from being this hero to all of a sudden that, no, I'm starting to see your flaws.
You're a human. You
know, and that's hard. I remember when that happened, but you know, like in every, you know, in every conversation, thinking back to, okay, I want my kids to be proud of what I said on a podcast, what I, you know, what I did, you know, and the way I conducted business and the way I treated people. And that is a huge thing to me. Now I use my hunting with my kids to shape that legacy. Like I made it a point this year where every one of my kids got a one-on-one hunt with me. I've got four. So, you know, it's
a lot of days set aside.
It is a lot of days set aside. And again, that whitetail space where I could pop up the blind and you're right next to a cornfield where we could move. And that made it, you know, made it easier to accomplish. It was 15 minutes from the house, you know? But that said, what I leave behind in my kids is going to speak more about me than anything else and the way they conduct themselves and the things that they do. And so I want them to have the same passion for hunting. I want them to have the same passion for the outdoors, but I want them to live their life well. Because, you know, as crazy as it sounds, it may be a byline. And at my funeral, and he loved to hunt mule deer, moving on. You think about it, like it's true.
Yeah,
you know, like, so if I can leave a legacy here and, you know, help conservation, that's one of the reasons, you know, we're at an event like this.
Yeah.
Those are all positive things. But who I leave behind is far more important than, you know, than anything else.
Yeah. I like that. I mean, if they only said at my funeral, the guy loved a bowhunt elk, I think that would be great. And I think it would pass. I think it would pass on to my kids everything that they would need to know. And I don't really, it's interesting. Like I like to take my kids hunting, you know, the ones that have showed interest and stuff. I don't push it on them. Yeah. And I don't, people have asked me like, oh, is it because my middle kid doesn't really want to hunt at all? Doesn't really want to have anything to do with it. And people have asked me, does that bother you? And to be honest, it doesn't really bother me. I just want to, I want to have something in my life that I feel so deeply that I chase, and I don't care what it is for them in that same regard, whatever it might be. I just hope that I've modeled that. And I hope that they find something, whatever it might be. And if it's hunting, that's awesome. You know, if it's something else, great, but just like go all in on it.
Yeah.
I think that's the most important to me.
Yep.
But what do you think, Brady?
Those are solid answers.
It's like I rehearsed it.
Yeah, solid answers.
Yeah, I appreciate you guys coming on.
No problem.
That was really fun. We've had you for, an hour and a half now, I guess? Hour and 40 minutes? 46. Yeah, we better cut you loose and let you get back to the booth.
I enjoyed that one a lot. Always enjoy talking to you guys.
The problem with these types of podcasts is, like, they come and go in an hour, and I feel like I could sit and talk for three or four.
I know.
Yeah, likewise. Yeah, I really appreciate it.
Nuggets.
Yeah, so definitely respect everything you guys are doing and love your passion for the game. And yeah, no, I appreciate the invite, being able to come up, chop it up for an hour and a half.
Give us, before you go, give us where people can find you if they don't follow you already. Tell us, I mean, you plug Eastman's, whatever you guys want.
Yeah, you can follow me, the couple podcasts, Eastman's Elevated, Eastman's Bow Hunting Journal. And then, we've got some stuff out there on YouTube, on the Eastman's Hunting TV. And then, you follow my social media, really, in IG, Brian Barney. And pretty much keep up with everything I do through those.
So, Eastman, do you guys do magazines? How many a year now? Do you do 12?
Six and six. Yep. So we've done that for a lot of years. So there's six of the Hunting Journal, six of the Bow Hunting Journal.
Yep.
We, you know, the research side, we spread the MRS across both of those. So if you want all of that, that's there. We've got the six podcasts now that we're up to.
Six?
Yeah, six. Yeesh.
A lot to manage.
A lot to manage. Believe me, it is a lot to manage. But it's fun. I love getting to work with all the podcast hosts. So you guys can find that on eastmans.com. They're all listed there.
Awesome.
You can find us at eastmans.com.
Very cool. Well, thanks, guys. We appreciate it.
Yeah,
that's awesome.
Thank you again. Yep.